I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times.
I came here today. I wanted to thank everybody that ever stood for me out here, all the supporters and people who came out and supported me through the ups and downs in and out of the system. I'm very thankful from the bottom of my heart. Everybody that ever mentioned my name or said Free Meek helped me get to this position. Meek free. I'm not on probation no more. I don't have to go to court no more. Thank you. I appreciate that a lot.
That was Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill earlier this week after pleading guilty to a firearms violation and after Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner dropped all other charges against him, signaling the end of his more than a decade on probation. His case has become a cause célèbre because of how a Philadelphia judge had punished him for a series of technical minor probation violations, things like not telling the judge about out-of-state concerts or riding a dirt bike in New York City. Mill and Jay-Z have teamed up and formed the Reform Alliance to, quote, change laws, policies, and practices that perpetuate injustice. Bobby Allen covered this story when he worked here at WHYY. He now reports for NPR, and he covered Mill's release from the criminal justice system earlier this week. And Bobby Allen joining us from the studios of NPR. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here again, Marty.
Is Meek Mill as famous as a criminal justice activist as he is a rapper?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. I think a lot of people who have been following the Meek Mill story have said, wait, who's this guy again? He's a really big deal in Philadelphia, and his associations with Nicki Minaj and Jay-Z and, you know, other sort of high-flying celebrities has put his name in the headlines. But I think he's probably known more for his legal struggles nationwide than he is for his music.
You know what's so interesting? I was looking at all the people that have been in support of him, and it includes athletes and, as you mentioned, Jay-Z and some other Hollywood people and some other rappers, civil rights activists, but also the owner of the New England Patriots, also the owner of the 76ers. It's a really interesting group of people that have come to his defense.
Yeah, and you know, all these people have banded together and have held up Meek Mill's case and his long probation and the so many times that his probation was extended and how he was under this, you know, pretty much minor criminal case his entire adult life. They've held that up as a reason to try to rally around legislation to make some big changes across Pennsylvania's criminal justice system. And it looks like they're actually taking steps to try to do something. At least they're introducing legislation. Who knows if they'll actually pass, but there's real movement and energy behind him now to try to take some systemic looks at the criminal justice system in Philly and statewide.
In fact, that's something we'll be talking about later on with our other two guests. Let's go back, Bobby. 12 years ago, Meek Mill was arrested on what drug and gun charges? What did he do?
Yeah, so back in January 2007, there was, you know, a tall, skinny guy with long braids known as Robert Rameek Williams. You know, if people in the neighborhood just called him Rameek, that's where Meek Mill comes from. He didn't like Robert. You know, he said that Robert kind of sounded too white of a name, so he went by Rameek. You know, he was a rapper. He didn't have much of a rap career at the time, but music was always his dream. He was walking around Southwest Philadelphia, and he came across a plainclothes police officer by the name of Reggie Graham. And they had a dispute. You know, the plainclothes officer accused him of selling drugs. Reggie says that Meek pointed a gun at him. Anyway, Meek was arrested on gun charges and on drug charges, and he was convicted and sentenced to 8 months in prison and a probation term of 5 years. In the grand scheme of what happens every day in a city like Philadelphia, this was not a meaningful or remarkable case, but then it became probably one of the most high-profile cases in recent Philadelphia history, and that's because, A, his case lasted forever. I mean, the probation kept being extended and extended and extended because of minor violations, but probably more importantly, because his stature kept rising and all of these high-profile backers of him came to his defense. And here we are today. The case is finally over. But yeah, it was a 12-year legal saga.
Well, let's talk about the judge. This is Judge Janice Brinkley. What do we need to know about her, Bobby?
Yeah, so Janice Brinkley has overseen Meek's case from the very beginning. So he was arrested in 2007, convicted under Janice Brinkley in 2008. And over the course of his entire adult life, he was appearing in and out of the Criminal Justice Center in Center City looking at Janice Brinkley, and their relationship took all sorts of unconventional and what lawyers would say prejudicial turns because it became personal. I mean, I remember being in the courtroom in a hearing where Nicki Minaj was there, his ex-girlfriend. It was packed with other Meek supporters. And Judge Brinkley said, let's go back to the chambers. And they all go back to the back of the courtroom. They shut the door. Nobody knows what happened. They come out. The hearing's over. And this was before, you know, his case was getting a lot of attention. It later comes out that Meek says, oh, the judge asked that I record a Boyz II Men cover and give her a shout out in the song, right? Then there was another instance where she showed up at the Broad Street Ministries where he was supposed to be handing out food and found him to be folding clothes and then scolded him in open court. She was basically spying on him while he was doing his community service and scolded him for it. These are very, very unusual instances to be had between a defendant in a criminal case and a judge. So it's not just that she was a judge in his case. They had a very different and unusual dynamic.
Tell us about some of these probation violations. They've been described as minor or technical, but what do we need to know?
Yeah, so he was supposed to just have 5 years of probation from his original 2007 arrest. But, Janice Brinkley says that, you know, more than a dozen times he violated the terms of his probation. And this is things like not failing a P test, not checking in with the court when he was supposed to, when he had a busy tour schedule, popping a wheelie on a dirt bike in Manhattan when he was recording a music video. You know, none of them are violent. None of them are major in the grand scheme of things, but eventually there was enough of them where Janice Brinkley said, you know what, you're not following the rules. You're basically thumbing your nose at me, thumbing your nose at the criminal justice system. You're going back behind bars, and that's what happened. But, you know, so many people in Philadelphia are faced with technical violations and are sent back to jail because of technical violations. Something like, you know, a third of the people in local jails in Philadelphia are there because of probation or parole violations. So his case was a window into a much larger problem.
And it seemed that this was 2017. He's ordered back to serve something like 2 to 4 years in prison for these violations.
That's right. So 2 to 4 years, he gets out after 5 months. And this is after some extraordinary circumstances. This is after Jay-Z takes to the New York Times to call for his freedom. This is after he hires some of the most talented and seasoned litigators to file papers and to argue on his behalf. You know, this is after Sixers co-owner Michael Rubin comes to his defense. Van Jones goes on CNN and says he should be released. I mean, he couldn't have had more high-profile allies, right? And even with this much support, it took this long for the case and for the books to be closed on this. So it really says a lot about how a probation case can chase you your entire life sometimes.
Well, earlier this summer, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court got involved in the case. What did that court do?
Yeah, so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court intervened and, you know, took a really hard look at the arresting officer, Reggie Graham, who, you know, was discredited in a completely separate proceeding. He allegedly stole money in a drug bust years ago. He was on the narcotics force in the Philadelphia Police Department, which has a very checkered past, and then supposedly lied about it to the FBI. And Reggie Graham, that former Philadelphia police officer, was the only witness in Mills' trial back in 2008. And because he was completely discredited, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, you know what? The case kind of crumbles if the main witness against you has no credibility.
Well, it should be said that Reginald Graham stands by his original statement about Meek Mill.
That's right. Yeah, he's been interviewed about this, and he says Meek Mill did point a gun at me. He says, you know, I've been sort of tarnished in the media, and I think he now lives in Florida. He's no longer with the Philadelphia police force, but he has denied the allegations that he lied and that anything, you know, untoward about him that's been accused, he's denied it, and he stood by his telling of events.
And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court also removed Judge Brinkley, correct?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so there are just so many strange and extraordinary examples of just how weird and bizarre their relationship was. And it just reached the point where it didn't seem, the court found, that she can be an impartial fact finder in his case anymore. So the judge who released him was Leon Tucker. And Leon Tucker said in the court that, you know, it's been a really long road for you. And it really has, right? I mean, a 12-year case over, you know, firearm and guns charges is pretty extraordinary.
And Larry Krasner, the district attorney here in Philadelphia, representing a new kind of district attorney. What was his response to this case?
Yeah, so the district attorney's office under Larry Krasner, you know, wanted Meek Mill to have a new trial, thought that the original trial was tainted with all the evidence that we've been talking about in mind. And then during the last hearing that recently happened, you know, agreed that, okay, you can plead. He pled to one firearms charge. It was a misdemeanor. Decided to press no additional charges. The judge imposed no additional penalty, and he's now free. And, you know, Krasner, one of his priorities, he has said for a while now, is, you know, dealing with the number of people who are on what he calls mass supervision. So the tens of thousands of people in Philadelphia who have to check in weekly or monthly with their probation or parole officers and so often find themselves behind bars for minor infractions. So Meek Mill was sort of a case to hold up and say, here's a good example of why the system ought to be reformed. And as we know, Krasner's a big reformer.
Indeed, he is. Talk a bit, if you could, about the Reform Alliance. This is this program or organization that Meek Mill has started with Jay-Z. What do they hope to do?
Yeah, so I think it's too soon to really test what they're trying to do in terms of we don't know yet if any of the legislative pushes are going to pass or if they're actually going to have a real effect on the system. But they got, you know, State Rep Jordan Harris to introduce a bill to, you know, aimed at some real sweeping changes to the state's probation and parole system, namely so that, you know, these probationary tails, as they're called, can't be extended and extended and extended like in Meek's case, and to like reward probationers when they are, you know, when they're following the rules and they're doing the right thing, that maybe these probationary terms can be reduced if you're showing good behavior. So a bill has been introduced after lobbying from this Reform Alliance. They've supposedly raised tens of millions of dollars to get behind other legislative pushes, but it's too soon to tell. We'll be waiting and following to see what actually happens, but he's still raising money and still saying that this Reform Alliance is not just going to advocate, but actually going to go for legislative change.
And final question to you, Bobby, what has it been like to cover this case, this story?
You know, early on, I remember going when I was at WHYY and going to some of these hearings. And like I said, there was almost nobody there. I mean, in the beginning, he had probation hearings so often and the local press wasn't really too interested. And then as the attention grew and grew and grew and the courtrooms got more and more packed, it was just fascinating to see how many people rallied behind Meek. I mean, you would always see people from his neighborhood there, maybe a few supporters. But yeah, the attention really exploded with very little time. But just, yeah, the dynamic between Janice and Meek, seeing that up close was really remarkable. And I want to say it's almost made for TV, but it already has been. So there's
exactly
a documentary series about it. So, yeah, really interesting case. And Meek has represented a lot about, you know, the problems with the criminal justice system in Philadelphia. And it'll be interesting to see what his alliance does going forward.
Well, Bobby Allen, thanks for getting our conversation started.
Hey, thanks.
That's Bobby Allen, used to work here at WHYY. He's now staff reporter for NPR covering national breaking news. More about Meek Mill after this short break. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill, who was arrested more than a decade ago for selling drugs and for a gun offense. After serving time in prison, he tangled with Pennsylvania's system of probation and with a Philadelphia judge who kept punishing him for what were considered minor technical violations. The Pennsylvania Superior Court removed that judge this summer and called for a new trial. Earlier this week, Mill pleaded guilty to illegal possession of a firearm, and Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner dropped all other charges against him, so Meek Mill is free. Here's Krasner speaking outside the courtroom.
This is a case, as I'm sure you all can understand from the proceedings today, that was not an exoneration. It was not an example of someone who was completely innocent, but it was, in my view, an example of excessive punishment, excessive supervision in terms of parole. I think it was also an example of some unfair procedures and some questionable integrity on the part of some of the original evidence in the case.
Today in Radio Times, what does Meek Mill's legal saga say about the system of probation and parole, and is it time for reform? Joining us by telephone is Mark Bergstrom, and he is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. He's also an associate teaching professor of sociology and criminology at Penn State University. Mark Bergstrom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Keith Reeves. He's a professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He's also department chair and director of the Urban Inequality and Incarceration Program at the college's Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. Keith Reeves, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines always open at 1-888-477-9499. We want your thoughts, your questions, your comments about this particular case and this particular issue. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Keith, let me start with you. Was justice served this week?
I believe so. I first want to thank Bobby for his description of the case, which was spot on. It was so nuanced and complicated, but it's incredibly deeply troubling for me and those of us who work in this space that there are lots of folks who were trapped in the system. And Meek happened to be the most profile, high profile of them. But it's a window into some really systemic issues that have to be addressed.
And when you talk about this system, it's the system of, in the case of Meek Mill, of probation, but parole and probation.
It's that. And it also goes beyond that. It goes with respect to arrests. It goes to surveillance of communities and then prosecution and then serving time and the supervision and the over-supervision, as the DA Krasner said. That really is deeply problematic.
I'd be curious, Mark Bergstrom, what's your takeaway with the legal saga of Meek Mill?
Well, I think, as the others have said, it may be an abuse of discretion or an excessive response to what was happening. And part of that is that we provide judges with a lot of discretion. It's usually exercised well, but there are times when you look at it and you might have some questions about why that happened.
Do you think in the case what we know about this particular judge, Mark Bergstrom, did she overstep her authority?
I don't know enough about the details of the case. What I've found over the years is that judges are looking at a lot of factors and they have a lot of information that I don't have. And so my starting point is to trust the discretion of judges. But I think this provides a really good opportunity to talk about frameworks that we should have within the system to try to encourage better practices, and I think this is a good opportunity for that.
You're nodding your head, Keith Reeves.
No, I agree with what Mark has said. I believe judges do the right thing, but what happens when a judge runs afoul of the rules, and who is there to oversee him or her? And the fact that this case took so long and it took a superior court to weigh in finally also gives us a window that something actually has to be examined and really looked at here.
Well, I think it's important for all of us to understand, so what is probation supposed to do? What is it supposed to be about? And, Mark, if I could begin with you. If someone, they've served their time, as Meek Mill did, he's released from prison, he is on probation, what are the requirements of probation?
Well, let me just back up a moment because there's sort of a mixing of apples and oranges, so let's just be clear on that. When someone serves time in jail or prison, that's part of a confinement sentence. And there is the opportunity in Pennsylvania for someone to be released from confinement before the maximum time.
Right.
And that release is parole. So initially, part of this community supervision involved parole supervision. And then in addition to that, courts have the authority to place someone directly in the community for community supervision, and that is probation. So as I understand this case, we were talking about both probation and parole. And that gets to some of the complications of the system. So then, specifically about probation, the conditions of community supervision are sort of like a contract. The idea is that by statute, there's a number of sort of standard conditions in terms of not, you know, committing a new offense and other things like that. But there's also efforts by the court through the probation department to try to structure and encourage positive behavior. So maybe that is imposing conditions like a curfew or restrictions on travel or participate in drug and alcohol treatment or other things like that. But the effort around probation is really focused on rehabilitation. It's really about trying to improve the prospects that this person will continue a law-abiding life. And part of that effort are both supervision strategies and treatment strategies. And so the question is, you know, what's the right balance,
right,
and how does it apply in every individual case?
Keith, you want to weigh in on this as well. Looking about, so someone is released from prison, whether they're on probation or parole. I mean, it seems to me the overall goal is to keep them out of prison.
That's right, yes. But we also have to take a look at how much community support they have, whether they've got family support, whether they've got sort of mental health issues and or drug alcohol treatment issues. From my perspective, it has to be a larger web of factors that we take a look at. That really does get at what Marcus said in terms of the balance between supervision and treatment.
I should add that you work with prisoners at a facility in Chester.
I do, yes, the State Correctional Institution at Chester, which holds about 1,200 men on a given day, uh-huh. Yes.
And when it comes to treatment, and I'm thinking about things like curfew violations, and perhaps, Mark, I can go back to you. If someone has done a curfew violation, is that enough of a violation to put them back in prison?
Well, you know, I guess it depends, right? But let's go back to that differentiation. If they're on parole, the consequence of a violation of parole is a return to jail or prison.
Right, right.
If they're on probation, the court actually has the opportunity to resentence the offender. But in either case, if there's a violation or a supposed violation, most probation and parole departments, most county departments or the state parole board, have something akin to what they call a sanctioning grid, which is really guidelines that the officer uses or the agent uses to try to maintain compliance in the community so that you're not automatically responding to any kind of violation with a revocation, that you're trying to sort of fix the problem or get the person on track in the community. So a lot of agencies have sort of standards in place to say, oh, this is a minor kind of infraction. Here's what we do to try to resolve that. So I don't know the specifics of what was in place in mm-hmm. this case, but oftentimes a single, you know, curfew violation doesn't result in a revocation. There's usually more than that, but that's very situational.
Chris has a question. I have this question as well. He says, my question is, where was Meek's probation officer in all of this time? If he's on probation, shouldn't he have an officer helping him? Can I toss that to you, Keith?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. But we also know that lots of probation officers in the state and across the country are overwhelmed and overworked and underpaid and understaffed. And so that's a factor that I hope that Reform Alliance will also look at. And some of the legislation will take a look at that as well.
But do you think there are other Meek Mills, Keith, in the system? While we're talking about Meek Mills, who was released this week, are there other Meek Mills in the system?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about that.
And because is there something unique about Pennsylvania?
I don't believe so. I mean, there's a 2016 sentencing report that has Pennsylvania ranked as number 8 with respect to the number of black males who are incarcerated. So I'm not sure. Mark might have a different answer to this. I'm not sure that Pennsylvania is unique and or is an outlier.
Do you think there's a racial component in all of this?
I believe so. But I also believe there's a class component and there's a neighborhood geography component. If you're growing up in disadvantage communities, structural poverty, discrimination, and unemployment, that leads into folks being put into the criminal justice system and into this web of surveillance and arrest and so on and so on.
How do you see that, Mark? The issue of class,
yeah,
class and race?
I think that that's consistent with what I've seen over the years. You know, it really has to do with, you know, where you deploy law enforcement and then how you respond to those kind of things. And that can sort of lead to differential involvement within the system in terms of who's being arrested, who's being prosecuted, who's being convicted and sentenced. And so I think there's all that. That's this whole disproportionality that we talk about. And it's not just race. It's many other factors that Keith's referred to. I think that all is in play and is a real concern. And in fact, one of the reasons that, you know, we have sentencing guidelines and things like that is to try to provide more objective sort of a more objective starting point for consideration of factors to try to remove race or class or other kind of factors from the consideration of sentencing.
We are talking about probation and parole here in Pennsylvania, using the case of, and I guess Meek Mills as an example of where problems can arise. That's Mark Bergstrom. He's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. He's also associate teaching professor of sociology and criminology at Penn State University. Keith Reeves with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's a professor of political science at Swarthmore College. Teaches at a class at a local prison in Chester, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. He's also a department chair and director of the Urban Inequality and Incarceration Program at the college's Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Here's an email from Paul. He says, if you continue to break probation requirements, you will be further punished. I have three kids in the military. If they were to pop on a drug test, they would be separated from service. Seems harsh, but those are the rules. I'd be curious, Keith, what you say in response to that. He's saying, you know, technical or not, these are violations.
I respect the question, but there are lots of folks. Meek Mills in particular has indicated that he's got a gun violence charge. He was very clear he used the gun for protection, was carrying it for protection. And so it gets to that factor I was talking about earlier about neighborhood. That has to be considered and taken into account. And a judge is supposed to use discretion. So I would want there to be some real individualized looking and examination of some of these cases.
Well, I'm curious, Mark, whether we should treat all violations the same. If you're, you know, you don't tell the judge that you have a concert somewhere in another state, should be treated the way any other more serious and frankly more criminal violation.
Well, I think you raise a good point about just sort of how the system maybe should operate, and I think it operates at two levels. So the first level is having sort of a broad framework, sort of some general rules of the road to try to promote fairness and uniformity and proportionality, all those kind of concepts. So you want to treat, you know, similar situations in a similar manner. But then I think you point out, you know, you need to look at the individual factors involving that offense and that individual. And I think that's a requirement that judges in Pennsylvania have, that they start with sort of this big picture framework and then they look at the individual factors in the case. And I think that's appropriate. But keep in mind that, you know, when we're talking about probation or violations of probation, you always have to look back at where it started, because what we see, at least at the commission when we're looking at statewide reporting sentences, is that, you know, there's a lot of negotiated pleas or a lot of sentences imposed on initial counts, initial convictions, that are mitigated or departures below the guidelines. They're pretty, you know, they're using probation instead of jail. So mm-hmm. sort of an alternative sentence from the start. And I think that sometimes factors into what happens as a consequence of a violation, because the judge, in effect, is, you know, recognizing a special circumstance or giving someone an opportunity at the time of the original sentence. And if there's a failure on that, a judge might respond differently than if this was a case that was sort of straight down the line, that this was a typical sentence for that typical offender, and the judge is thinking about that. So I think there's a lot of factors the judge has to consider, but I think you're right that looking at the individual, looking at those individual factors, there's a really important aspect of judicial discretion.
Well, Meek Mill was on probation, Keith, for approximately a dozen years. I guess under a system like that, he could have been on probation for the rest of his life if he failed to do some of the things that the judge wanted him to do.
Yeah, that's right. And so the fact that this happened for 12 years is just problematic, as Bobby was saying in an earlier segment. But what happens and who looks at whether something is excessive, as D.A. Krasner said, and what corrective is there to address when something is really overly excessive, as certainly was the case with Meek Mill.
Well, and one of the things that D.A. Krasner also said, we didn't play the clip, but he talked about, from his perspective, he felt as if Meek Mill had evolved, I think that was the word he used, meaning, I guess, grown up, you know, began to take a harder look at his behaviors. And there were some problems, clearly. But he's also calling for the system to evolve as well. Do you think it's possible in Pennsylvania?
I'm hoping so. It has to. The state spends something on the order of $2.1 billion, with a B, dollars on the whole criminal justice enterprise in the state. And it has to evolve. We as taxpayers can't afford this when we've got competing demands for education, for child care, for roads and bridges, for elderly services, and so forth. So my hope is that the budget piece will also be examined when the legislation and those conversations move forward.
Mark, Bobby Allen, who got us started, a reporter on this case, said that certainly in Philadelphia, a good percentage of people are in jail or in prison because of some of these technical violations. Do you think there's the will in Pennsylvania to at least address this issue?
There's definitely a will, but I think I heard part of your earlier segment with discussion of legislation introduced by Representative Harris. There's also legislation by Senator Williams, really looking specifically at some of these issues of duration of supervision and consecutive sentencing and things like that. But there's even a broader effort that we've been engaged in for several years called Justice Reinvestment Initiative, sort of the second round of that. And that would really try to address some of these same issues about duration of probation and intensity and things like that, and really try to, from a sort of a structural point of view, try to address some of these bigger issues. If I could just mention, though,
Mark, only because we're up on a break here and I don't want to interrupt you mid-sentence, let me just quickly reintroduce you. We're going to take that short break and then we'll pick up where we left off. Talking about probation and parole here in Pennsylvania, some calls for reform based on the experiences of Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill. He did serve time for drug and gun charges, but spent almost a dozen years essentially on probation, parole and probation in Pennsylvania. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap what we're talking about here. Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill is free after battling the city's criminal justice system. He was first sentenced 12 years ago on gun and drug charges. He was 19 years old. After his release from prison came a protracted battle with a judge over probation violations. On Tuesday, he pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor firearms charge while all other charges were dropped, so he is no longer on probation. Many see Meek Mill's treatment as an example of some problems with probation requirements and judicial discretion and are using his legal saga as a reason for reform. Our guests are Keith Reeves. He's a professor of political science at Swarthmore College, department chair and director of the Urban Inequality and Incarceration Program at the college's Lange Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. He is here with us in our Philadelphia studio. And joining us by telephone, Mark Bergstrom, and he is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, also associate teaching professor of sociology and criminology at Penn State University. Mark, we're back at you. Do you remember what you wanted to say?
Sure. Just a little note about, we're talking about a lot of structural things, but I think one of the other things in this case or other cases where there are concerns about abuse or whatever is the role of sort of the attorneys in the case and the appellate standards we have. And just not to get too far into the weeds, but we have a pretty high standard for having a review by the Superior Court of the abuse of discretion of a judge, maybe working outside the lines on some of these things. One thing that might be worth considering is there a different standard? Would there be an opportunity as a change to look at when a case can be brought to the Superior Court to review factors like this? Because as Keith said, it took a long time for this to make it to that point. And it could be that we have such a high standard. I believe it's manifest abuse of discretion to get to there. And maybe there's something that could be done to address these things earlier on in individual cases.
Well, I wonder, Mark, whether then you want to look at a judge's, I guess, track record on a particular case, or whether they have a sort of a habit of over involvement in the cases that appear before them.
Well, I'm just saying if the party in the case, if the attorney for the defendant really thinks there's an issue of a real concern about how the case is being handled, I suspect it's very difficult to appeal that issue or to have a review of that issue by an appellate court just because of the standards in place. And so as we're talking about, you know, why did this go so long? Is there a mechanism? You know, that might be something to consider along with these other changes that we're looking at about what does it take to have a review of a case where you think something has gone off the rails.
Let me quote from Vulture.com, and this is Meek Mill's attorneys. This goes back a little bit. Accused the judge in this case of inappropriate conduct, like requesting that Mill give her a shout-out in a recording. This is something that Bobby Allen referenced. Also asking the rapper to leave Roc Nation to sign with a friend of hers. Also showing up at community service. I'm just curious, Keith, just based on your experiences, what you make of those allegations?
They're pretty outrageous. I've worked with a lot of judges who have great integrity. To Mark's point, one wonders whether this is such an outlier of a case and or is there something really much more systemic. But it requires a review so that we can be transparent, but equally as important, the folks can trust the criminal justice system, that they are going to be treated fairly and treated with the dignity and respect that I believe they deserve.
Let me read an email from Cindy. I'll toss this back to you, Keith. She says, while I don't know who Meek Mill is, let's make no mistake, the entire probation, parole, and prison system has a greater effect on black and brown people and is designed to unjustly keep minorities in prison. Can you speak to that?
I believe that's true. I know it both from the data, but also from my work. I know it also anecdotally. But it gets to some of the structural pieces that Mark was talking about and that I had mentioned in an earlier segment. We have to look at neighborhood disadvantage, neighborhood poverty, discrimination, the school-to-prison pipeline, the interpersonal gun violence that is so rampant in so many of our communities. And until we deal with some of those structural issues, for all of the wonderful ideas that are embedded in some of the reform legislation, we're not going to really address some of these larger issues.
So if some kids are hanging out in, let's say, you know, a nice middle-class, upper-middle-class community versus hanging out on the street corner in North Philly.
Absolutely. You could be in Montgomery County and the line to Philadelphia County is just a few miles and the infraction is treated differently. It's processed very differently. So I would hope that we would look at, for example, San Francisco has this really interesting experiment in terms of blind charging. So race and demographic data are stripped from the cases before prosecutors have a chance to look at them. Mm. So it's a great idea. Will be interesting to see what happens there and if something similar can be undertaken here in Pennsylvania.
So blind charging, meaning they literally do not know who the person is or anything about them.
Exactly. They don't know race. They don't know context. They don't know geography. They do know the facts of the case. And only after they've made an initial decision about whether to charge or proceed are they given access to recordings and other data and other affidavits and information and so forth. And then if they make a second recommendation, they have to explain the difference between the first recommendation and the second. Uh-huh. But this is a way to deal, as Mark and Bobby have mentioned, is a way to deal with the sort of racial disparity that is so endemic, I believe, in the system.
What do you think of that, Mark?
Yeah, I think anything that tries to improve the system, you know, justice is blind, and I think trying to figure out things that work. You know, we've talked about, you know, upstream at just where you're deploying law enforcement and things like that have impacts as well. So I think that's one decision point, the prosecution about where to go and how to handle things and trying to neutralize factors that shouldn't be in play. I think, as Keith said, it's a, you know, it's a big system, a lot of opportunities and needs throughout the system.
But when putting together sentencing guidelines, Mark, can you have a kind of if not one size fits all, where you can say, well, if this is the violation, this will be the response, because we're dealing with human beings, which are, of course, sure. You know, behavior is so complicated and so contextual.
Yeah, that's a really good question. The commission has a lot of mandates, and our primary mandate has been sentencing guidelines. So we provide this sort of starting point for sentences that sort of recognize here's some factors, some objective factors that we're going to use to come up with sort of a similar array of sentencing options for similar cases. But we give judges a lot of discretion within that. I mean, purposefully, because the Commonwealth is very diverse in terms of just geography and, you know, everything else about a population and so forth. So judges do have a lot of discretion. And one question before the commission, one area the commission continues to look at is, can we or should we be a little bit more focused so that we're giving judges a little bit more guidance around certain things, because that may tighten that kind of review or allow for, a differential treatment of people that look and seem to be about the same. I think that same thing applies to resentencing guidelines that we're working on. We want to give judges discretion so that they can look at the individual facts of the case and this individual human being, but you also want to have some standards in place so that you don't have bias or other kinds of unfairness, whether explicit or implicit. And so I think, you know, it's always a balance between those two approaches.
You agree with that, Keith?
Absolutely. Mark is spot on.
Well, and there has been some controversy about using algorithms in coming up with sentencing. And I guess picking up on what you were saying earlier, Keith Reeves, about that it seems to matter where people live and whether they're a man or a woman or what race they are. But when you begin to put them and use them in algorithms, then you can end up in a kind of a box.
Yeah, and we are, as you pointed out, very complicated human beings, and those neighborhood disadvantage factors play in, and the role of attorneys and whether someone is a public defender or not, the judge, the circumstance of the case, all of that factors into the ultimate outcome. And I believe, as Mark has said, you've got to give judges some bandwidth, but at the same time really allow him and her to really decide the individual facts of the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky balancing act, Mark, is it not?
Well, it is, and our commission is at the center of that, because we have a mandate to develop exactly that, an algorithm, a risk assessment for use of sentencing. And I can tell you a couple of takeaways from that. You know, the first takeaway is exactly what we've been talking about all morning, is concerns about racial bias and other types of bias in the system, and how that is really just, it sort of taints the system to some degree. If you're developing an algorithm, a risk assessment, and you're trying to use good data, but if there's questions about the reliability or the accuracy of that data, or that it's tainted, that undermines the whole, you know, the whole prospect of this. So that's one thing. But I think what the commission has tried to do in recognizing it has this mandate is how do you make proper use of something like that if you're developing it? And the first thing is to try to do everything you can to neutralize things like race and that in the instrument, and then look at how you use the instrument, that it's not used for punishment, but it's really used to identify alternatives or to provide judges with better information about what to do in this specific case. Take full advantage of these alternative programs we have, but those don't always happen. You know, those don't always become part of a negotiated plea without some information about why this person would benefit from this program. So I think, you know, our approach, and it's, you know, this is a tough area, is to try to come up with an instrument that can at least be used to identify cases where more information can help judges make better decisions, individualized decisions.
Keith, let me go back to you and actually have you talk a bit about some of the work that you do with prisoners. You work at, is it called SCI Chester?
Yes, that's the acronym, but it's the State Correctional Institution at Chester. So right. It's one of the state facilities in this vast criminal justice enterprise here in Pennsylvania. But I've been working in the space since 2012, teaching a course that's part of the Inside Out exchange program headquartered at Temple. And we essentially go in and we take our undergraduate students into the prison, and we have classes with individuals who are incarcerated there who are incredibly bright and very smart but who also want to be educated. And we have a class entitled Politics of Punishment, and we look at the criminal justice system but also policy, and we look at reforms. And the groups of students come up with all kinds of group projects. So for all the things that we've been talking about this morning, we've got a really interesting group of students who've been strategizing about these ideas and coming up with ideas of their own, particularly from folks who are actually inside the system. Yeah. And so they know best what they need and what they want and what reforms are needed.
So are the prisoners the students or are they the teachers?
Both. But right. One of the most profound things that was said to me a few years ago was one of the inside students, we called them, said because of how we grew up in the neighborhoods that we are a part of, any one of us, a bad decision can land us to where he is. And that has always guided my work since then, and it's true. And so if the Sentencing Commission and other reform efforts can really sort of have that at the center of its work, as Meek Mill said himself, he was a young kid who was trying to protect himself. We've got lots of communities and lots of individuals walking around in urban and rural spaces who are carrying knives and guns, unfortunately, because they're trying to protect themselves. So what happens when those folks are pulled aside, that firearm or that knife is found on him or her, and they explain, I'm just trying to protect myself. I have no intention of using it. And how do we then treat them? And the system has trapped so many of these individuals, and we have to do something about that. We have to.
I'd be curious what you say in response to that, Mark, the idea that at least coming from this prisoner that Keith has worked with, saying, you know, one mistake, one false move, and I'm in deep trouble.
No, I understand that. I've heard that, and I agree with Keith that that's really we have to sort of figure out how we navigate this whole thing about you know justice in Pennsylvania and how we understand those issues. But I will say just on the firearms issue about having a firearm, you know, we have to think about both sides of that, and that's why it's so complicated because. Someone might have a firearm on them, and that might not result in anything harmful. But you know, think about all the firearm violence that we're seeing, you know, in Philadelphia or across the Commonwealth, and what is how do we respond to that? And a lot of people say, well, the response is, you know, if someone has a criminal record, they shouldn't have a firearm. We should be very vigilant about that and really act on that aggressively. But it's hard to sort out cases, you know, about what's the intention, why do you have it, and so forth. So individualized information to the court, I think, really helps to improve the quality of those decisions. But it's tough because you have a given situation that could go in two different directions. And that's, that's why judges have a tough job. They have to try to balance all of this and make sense of it.
We're almost out of time, but Keith, looks like you want to say something.
No, I agree with that. But one of the things I would add is I would hope that prosecutors, before he or she suggests the sentence, actually meet and talk with the individuals, both victims and perpetrators, to find out context. That is everything. And oftentimes, even if you have to charge as a prosecutor, you might come in with a lesser charge or, as Marcus said, some alternative to jail or prison.
Well, Keith Reith, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Mark Bergstrom, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure to join you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show was produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. We do want to close things out. This is Meek Mill's Philadelphia, released in 2018, part of his Legends of the Summer.
Showtime. King's back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put a lot for the 215.
Meek time. Meek time.
It's Meek time. Huh. For the love of the city.
For the city.
I'm sitting up on the block.
On the block.
12 o'clock when you're willing.
When you're willing.
12 in the car. They want to see me in the cage. I'd rather see me in the brave. A motivation on the grand. And going live on the nip. You gonna say, got me. Who out the streets?
Me.
Who driving heat?
Me.
Who let the city up? Pull up that Billy truck. Rats on them, I think I'm a fee.
Me.
Who dropped this shit through the way?
Me.
Who really dropping that fight?
Me.
Back on the water, listen.
running hoe.